17. They couldn't, though, not at first, because the path was too steep and narrow. But later, as they approached the bottom of the mesa, it grew wider and more forgiving. Talk once more became practical, and Eddie told Roland about the book, the Dogen or the Hogan, and the author's oddly disputable name. He recounted the oddity of the copyright page, not entirely sure that Roland grasped this part, and said it had made him wonder if something was pointing toward the sun, too. That seemed like a crazy idea, but I think that if Benny Sleitman was helping his father inform on us, Roland said, Jake would know.
Are you sure he doesn't?
Eddie asked. This gave Roland some pause. Then he shook his head. Jake suspects the father.
He told you that?
He didn't have to. They had almost reached the horses, who raised their heads alertly and seemed glad to see them.
He's out there at the Rocking Bee, Eddie said. Maybe we ought to take a ride out there, invent some reason to bring him back to the pears.
He trailed off, looking at Roland closely.
No?
No.
Why not?
Because this is Jake's part of it.
That's hard, Roland. He and Benny Sleitman like each other, a lot. If Jake ends up being the one to show the collar what his dad's been doing,
Jake will do what he needs to do, Roland said. So will we all.
But he's still just a boy, Roland. Don't you see that?
He won't be for much longer, Roland said, and mounted up. He hoped Eddie didn't see the momentary wince of pain that cramped his face when he swung his right leg over the saddle. But of course, Eddie did. Chapter 3 The Dogen, Part 2 1 Jake and Benny Sleitman spent the morning of that same day moving hay bales from the upper lofts of the Rocking Bee's three inner barns to the lower lofts, then breaking them open. The afternoon was for swimming and water fighting in the Y, which was still pleasant enough if one avoided the deep pools. Those had grown cold with the season. In between these two activities, they ate a huge lunch in the bunkhouse with half a dozen of the hands, not Sleitman the elder. He was off at Telford's Buckhead Ranch, working a stock trade.
"I ain't seen that boy of Ben's work so hard in my life," Cookie said as he put fried chops down on the table and the boys dug in eagerly. "You'll wear him plumb out, Jake."
That was Jake's intention, of course. After haying in the morning, swimming in the afternoon, and a dozen or more barn jumps for each of them by the red light of evening, he thought Benny would sleep like the dead. The problem was he might do the same himself. When he went out to wash at the pump, sunset come and gone by then, leaving ashes of roses deepening to true dark, he took Oi with him. He splashed his face clean and flicked drops of water for the animal to catch, which he did with great alacrity. Then Jake dropped to one knee and gently took hold of the sides of the Billy Bumbler's face.
"Listen to me, Oi."
"Oi."
"I'm going to go to sleep, but when the moon rises, I want you to wake me up, quietly. Do you ken?"
"Ken."
Which might mean something or nothing. If someone had been taking wagers on it, Jake would have bet on something. He had great faith in Oi, or maybe it was love, or maybe those things were the same. "When the moon rises." "Say moon, Oi."
"Moon."
Sounded good, but Jake would set his own internal alarm clock to wake him up at moonrise, because he wanted to go out to where he'd seen Benny's Da and Andy that other time. That queer meeting worried at his mind more rather than less as time went by. He didn't want to believe Benny's Da was involved with the wolves, Andy either. But he had to make sure, because it was what Roland would do. For that reason, if no other. 2. The two boys lay in Benny's room. There was one bed, which Benny had of course offered to his guest, but Jake had refused it. What they'd come up with instead was a system by which Benny took the bed on what he called even-hand nights, and Jake took it on odd-hand nights. This was Jake's night for the floor, and he was glad. Benny's goose-down-filled mattress was far too soft. In light of his plan to rise with the moon, the floor was probably better, safer. Benny lay with his hands behind his head, looking up at the ceiling. He had coaxed Oi up onto the bed with him, and the Bumbler lay sleeping in a curled comma, his nose beneath his cartoon squiggle of a tail.
Jake?
A whisper.
You asleep?
No.
Me neither.
A pause.
It's been great having you here.
It's been great for me, Jake said, and meant it. Sometimes, being the only kid gets lonely.
Don't I know it? And I was always the only one.
Jake paused.
Bet you were sad after your sister died.
Sometimes I'm still sad.
At least he said it in a matter-of-fact tone, which made it easier to hear.
Reckon you'll stay after you beat the wolves?
Probably not long.
You're on a quest, aren't you?
I guess so.
For what?
The quest was to save the Dark Tower in this ware, and the Rose in the New York ware he and Eddie and Susanna had come from. But Jake did not want to say this to Benny, much as he liked him. The Tower and the Rose were kind of secret things, the Quartet's business. But neither did he want to lie.
Roland doesn't talk about stuff much, he said.
A longer pause. The sound of Benny shifting, doing it quietly so as not to disturb Oi.
He scares me a little, your din.
Jake thought about that, then said,
He scares me a little, too.
He scares my pa.
Jake was suddenly very alert.
Really?
Yes, he says it wouldn't surprise him if, after you got rid of the wolves, you turned on us. Then he said he was just joking, but that the old cowboy with the hard face scared him. I reckon that must have been your din, don't you?
Yeah, Jake said.
Jake had begun thinking Benny had gone to sleep when the other boy asked,
What was your room like back where you came from?
Jake thought of his room, and at first found it surprisingly hard to picture. It had been a long time since he'd thought of it, and now that he did, he was embarrassed to describe it too closely to Benny. His friend lived well indeed by Kala standards. Jake guessed there were very few small-hold kids Benny's age with their own rooms, but he would think a room such as Jake could describe that of an enchanted prince. The television? The stereo with all his records? And the headphones for privacy? His posters of Stevie Wonder and the Jackson Five? His microscope, which showed him things too small to see with the naked eye? Was he supposed to tell this boy about such wonders and miracles?
It was like this, only I had a desk.
Jake said at last.
A writing desk?
Benny got up on one elbow.
Well, yeah, Jake said, the tone implying, sheesh, what else?
Paper? Pens? Quill pens?
Paper, Jake agreed.
Here at least was a wonder Benny could understand.
And pens, but not quill. Ball.
Ball pens?
I don't understand.
So Jake began to explain, but halfway through he heard a snore. He looked across the room and saw Benny still facing him, but now with his eyes closed. Oi opened his eyes, they were bright in the darkness, then winked at Jake. After that, he appeared to go back to sleep. Jake looked at Benny for a long time, deeply troubled in ways he did not precisely understand or want to. At last, he went to sleep himself. 3. Some dark, dreamless time later, he came back to a semblance of wakefulness because of pressure on his wrist. Something pulling there, almost painful.
Teeth.
Oi's.
Oi, no, quit it,
he mumbled, but Oi would not stop. He had Jake's wrist in his jaws and continued to shake it gently from side to side, stopping occasionally to administer a brisk tug. He only quit when Jake finally sat up and stared dopily out into the silver-flooded night.
Moon,
Oi said. He was sitting on the floor beside Jake, jaws open in an unmistakable grin, eyes bright. They should have been bright, a tiny white stone burned deep down in each one.
Moon!
Yeah, Jake whispered, and then closed his fingers around Oi's muzzle.
Hush!
He let go and looked over at Benny, who was now facing the wall and snoring deeply. Jake doubted if a howitzer shell would wake him.
Moon,
Oi said, much more quietly. Now he was looking out the window.
Moon, moon, moon.
4. Jake would have ridden bareback, but he needed Oi with him, and that made bareback difficult, maybe impossible. Luckily, the little border pony Cy Overholzer had loaned him was as tame as a tabby cat, and there was a scuffy old practice saddle in the barn's tack room that even a kid could handle with ease. Jake saddled the horse, then tied his bedroll behind to the part Kala Cowboys called the boat. He could feel the weight of the Ruger inside the roll, and, if he squeezed, the shape of it as well. The duster with the commodious pocket in the front was hanging on a nail in the tack room. Jake took it, whipped it into something like a fat belt, and cinched it around his middle. Kids in his school had sometimes worn their outer shirts that way on warm days. Like those of his room, this memory seemed far away, part of a circus parade that had marched through town and then left. That life was richer. A voice deep in his mind whispered. "This one is truer," whispered another, even deeper. He believed that second voice, but his heart was still heavy with sadness and worry as he led the border pony out through the back of the barn and away from the house. Oi padded along at his heel, occasionally looking up at the sky and muttering, "Moon! Moon!" but mostly sniffing the crisscrossing scents on the ground. This trip was dangerous. Just crossing Divar Titi Hwai, going from the Kala side of things to the Thunderclap side, was dangerous, and Jake knew it. Yet what really troubled him was the sense of looming heartache. He thought of Benny, saying it had been great to have Jake at the Rocking Bee to chum around with. He wondered if Benny would feel the same way a week from now.
"Doesn't matter," he sighed. "It's Ka."
"Ka,"
Oi said, then looked up. "Moon. Ka, moon. Moon, Ka."
"Shut up," Jake said, not unkindly.
"Shut up, Ka,"
Oi said amiably.
"Shut up, moon. Shut up, ache. Shut up, Oi."
It was the most he'd said in months, and once it was out, he fell silent. Jake walked his horse another 10 minutes, past the bunkhouse and its mixed music of snores, grunts, and farts, then over the next hill. At that point, with the east road in sight, he judged it safe to ride. He unrolled the duster, put it on, then deposited Oi in the pouch, and mounted up. 5. He was pretty sure he could go right to the place where Andy and Sleitman had crossed the river, but reckoned he'd only have one good shot at this, and Roland would have said pretty sure wasn't good enough in such a case. So he went back to the place where he and Benny had tented instead, and from there to the jut of granite which had reminded him of a partially buried ship. Once again, Oi stood panting into his ear. Jake had no problem sighting on the round rock with the shiny surface. The dead log that had washed up against it was still there, too, because the river hadn't done anything but fall over the last weeks. There'd been no rain whatever, and this was something Jake was counting on to help him. He scrambled back up to the flat place where he and Benny had tented out. Here he'd left his pony tethered to a bush. He led it down to the river, then scooped up Oi and rode across. The pony wasn't big, but the water still didn't come up much higher than his fetlocks. In less than a minute, they were on the far bank. It looked the same on this side, but wasn't. Jake knew it right away. Moonlight or no moonlight, it was darker somehow. Not exactly the way Todash, New York had been dark, and there were no chimes, but there was a similarity just the same. A sense of something waiting, and eyes that could turn in his direction if he was foolish enough to alert their owners to his presence. He had come to the edge of Endworld. Jake's flesh broke out in goosebumps, and he shivered. Oi looked up at him.
"It's all right," Jake whispered. "Just had to get it out of my system."
He dismounted, put Oi down, and stowed the duster in the shadow of the round rock. He didn't think he'd need a coat for this part of his excursion. He was sweating, nervous. The babble of the river was loud, and he kept shooting glances across to the other side, wanting to make sure no one was coming. He didn't want to be surprised. That sense of presence, of others, was both strong and unpleasant. There was nothing good about what lived on this side of the Divar Titi Hwai. Of that much Jake was sure. He felt better when he'd taken the Dockers clutch out of the bedroll, cinched it in place, and then added the Ruger. The Ruger made him into a different person, one he didn't always like. But here, on the far side of the Y, he was delighted to feel gun weight against his ribs and delighted to be that person, that gunslinger. Something farther off to the east screamed like a woman in life-ending agony. Jake knew it was only a rock cat. He'd heard them before, when he'd been at the river with Benny, either fishing or swimming. But he still put his hand on the butt of the Ruger until it stopped. Oi had assumed the bowing position, front paws apart, head lowered, rump pointed skyward. Usually this meant he wanted to play, but there was nothing playful about his bared teeth.
"'It's okay,' Jake said.
He rummaged in his bedroll again. He hadn't bothered to bring a saddlebag until he found a red-checked cloth. This was Sleitman the Elder's neckerchief, stolen 4 days previous from beneath the bunkhouse table where the foreman had dropped it during a game of Watch Me and then forgotten it.
"'Quite the little thief I am,' Jake thought. "'My dad's gun? Now Benny's dad's snot rag. I can't tell if I'm working my way up or down.'
It was Roland's voice that replied. "'You're doing what you were called here to do. Why don't you stop beating your breast and get started?' Jake held the neckerchief between his hands and looked down at Oi.
"'This always works in the movies,' he said to the bumbler. "'I have no idea if it works in real life, especially after weeks have gone by.'
He lowered the neckerchief to Oi, who stretched out his long neck and sniffed it delicately.
"'Find this smell, Oi. Find it and follow it.
Oi!'
But he just sat there looking up at Jake.
"'This, Dumbo!'
Jake said, letting him smell it again.
"'Find it. Go on!'
Oi got up, turned around twice, then began to saunter north along the bank of the river. He lowered his nose occasionally to the rocky ground, but seemed a lot more interested in the occasional dying woman howl of the rock cat. Jake watched his friend with steadily diminishing hope. Well, he'd seen which way Sleitman had gone. He could go in that direction himself, course around a little, see what there was to see. Oi turned around, came back toward Jake, then stopped. He sniffed a patch of ground more closely. The place where Sleitman had come out of the water? It could have been. Oi made a thoughtful hoofing sound far back in his throat and then turned to his right. East. He slipped sinuously between two rocks. Jake, now feeling at least a tickle of hope, mounted up and followed. 6. They hadn't gone far before Jake realized Oi was following an actual path that wound through the hilly, rocky, arid land on this side of the river. He began to see signs of technology, a cast-off, rusty electrical coil, something that looked like an ancient circuit board poking out of the sand, tiny shards and shatters of glass. In the black moonlight-created shadow of a large boulder, he spied what looked like a whole bottle. He dismounted, picked it up, poured out God knew how many decades or centuries of accumulated sand, and looked at it. Written on the side in raised letters was a word he recognized. Nozzola.
"'The drink of finer bum hugs everywhere,' Jake murmured, and put the bottle down again.
Beside it was a crumpled-up cigarette pack. He smoothed it out, revealing a picture of a red-lipped woman wearing a jaunty red hat. She was holding a cigarette between two glamorously long fingers. Party appeared to be the brand name. Oi, meanwhile, was standing 10 or 12 yards farther along and looking back at him over one low shoulder.
"Okay," Jake said, "I'm coming."
Other paths joined the one they were on, and Jake realized this was a continuation of the East Road. He could see only a few scattered boot prints and smaller, deeper footprints. These were in places guarded by high rocks, wayside coves the prevailing winds didn't often reach. He guessed the boot prints were Sleitman's, the deep footprints, Andy's. There were no others. But there would be, and not many days from now, either. The prints of the wolves' gray horses coming out of the east. They would also be deep prints, Jake reckoned. Deep like Andy's. Up ahead, the path breasted the top of a hill. On either side were fantastically misshapen organ-pipe cactuses with great thick barrel arms that seemed to point every which way. Oi was standing there, looking down at something and once more seeming to grin. As Jake approached him, he could smell the cactus plants. The odor was bitter and tangy. It reminded him of his father's martinis. He sat astride his pony beside Oi, looking down. At the bottom of the hill on the right was a shattered concrete driveway. A sliding gate had been frozen half open ages ago, probably long before the wolves started raiding the borderland collars for children. Beyond it was a building with a curved metal roof. Small windows lined the side Jake could see, and his heart lifted at the sight of the steady white glow that came through them. Not Seeners, and not light bulbs either, what Roland called sparklights. Only fluorescence threw that kind of white light. In his New York life, fluorescent lights made him think mostly of unhappy, boring things, giant stores where everything was always on sale and you could never find what you wanted. Sleepy afternoons at school, when the teacher droned on and on about the trade routes of ancient China or the mineral deposits of Peru, and rain poured endlessly down outside, and it seemed the closing bell would never ring. Doctor's offices, where you always wound up sitting on a tissue-covered exam table in your underpants, cold and embarrassed and somehow positive that you would be getting a shot. Tonight, though, those lights cheered him up. "Good boy," he told the bumbler. Instead of responding as he usually did by repeating his name, Oi looked past Jake and commenced a low growl. At the same moment, the pony shifted and gave a nervous whinny. Jake reined him, realizing that bitter but not entirely unpleasant smell of gin and juniper had gotten stronger. He looked around and saw two spiny barrels of the cactus tangle on his right swiveling slowly and blindly toward him. There was a faint grinding sound, and dribbles of white sap were running down the cactus's central barrel. The needles on the arms swinging toward Jake looked long and wicked in the moonlight. The thing had smelled him, and it was hungry. "Come on," he told Oi, and booted the pony's sides lightly. The pony needed no further urging. It hurried downhill, not quite trotting, toward the building with the fluorescent lights. Oi gave the moving cactus a final, mistrustful look, then followed them. 7. Jake reached the driveway and stopped. About 50 yards farther down the road, it was now very definitely a road, or had been once upon a time, train tracks crossed and then ran on toward the Divar Titiwai, where a low bridge took them across. The Fokin called that bridge the Causeway. The older Fokin, Callahan had told them, called it the Devil's Causeway. "The trains that bring the Runt ones back from Thunderclap come on those tracks," he murmured to Oi. And did he feel the tug of the beam? Jake was sure he did. He had an idea that when they left Calabrin Sturgis, if they left Calabrin Sturgis, it would be along those tracks. He stood where he was a moment longer, feet out of the stirrups, then headed the pony up the crumbling driveway toward the building. To Jake it looked like a Quonset hut on a military base. Oi, with his short legs, was having hard going on the broken-up surface. That busted-up paving would be dangerous for his horse, too. Once the frozen gate was behind them, he dismounted and looked for a place to tether his mount. There were bushes close by, but something told him they were too close, too visible. He led the pony out onto the hard pan, stopped, and looked around at Oi.
"Stay. Stay, Oi. Ake."
Jake found more bushes behind a pile of boulders like a strew of huge and eroded toy blocks. Here he felt satisfied enough to tether the pony. Once it was done, he stroked the long, velvety muzzle.
"Not long," he said. "Can you be good?"
The pony blew through his nose and appeared to nod, which meant exactly nothing, Jake knew. And it was probably a needless precaution anyway. Still, better safe than sorry. He went back to the driveway and bent to scoop the bumbler up. As soon as he straightened, a row of brilliant lights flashed on, pinning him like a bug on a microscope stage. Holding Oi in the curve of one arm, Jake raised the other to shield his eyes. Oi whined and blinked. There was no warning shout, no stern request for identification, only the faint snuffle of the breeze. The lights were turned on by motion sensors, Jake guessed. What came next? Machine gun fire, directed by dipolar computers? A scurry of small but deadly robots, like those Roland, Eddie, and Susanna had dispatched in the clearing where the beam they were following had begun? Maybe a big net dropping from overhead, like in this jungle movie he'd seen once on TV. Jake looked up. There was no net. No machine guns, either. He started walking forward again, picking his way around the deepest of the potholes, and jumping over a washout. Beyond this ladder, the driveway was tilted and cracked, but mostly whole.
"You can get down now," he told Oi. "Boy, you're heavy. Watch out or I'll have to stick you in Weight Watchers."
He looked straight ahead, squinting and shielding his eyes from the fierce glare. The lights were in a row, running just beneath the Quonset's curved roof. They threw his shadow out behind him, long and black. He saw rock-cat corpses, two on his left and two more on his right. Three of them were little more than skeletons. The fourth was in a high state of decomposition, but Jake could see a hole that looked too big for a bullet. He thought it had been made by a bob bolt. The idea was comforting. No weapons of super science at work here. Still, he was crazy not to be hightailing it back toward the river and the collar beyond it, wasn't he?
"Crazy," he said.
"Crazy,"
Oi said, once more padding along at Jake's heel. A minute later, they reached the door of the hut. Above it, on a rusting steel plate, was this: North Central Positronics Limited. Northeast Corridor, Arc Quadrant, Outpost 16, Medium Security. Verbal Entry Code Required. On the door itself, now hanging crooked by only two screws, was another sign. A joke? Some sort of nickname? Jake thought it might be a little of both. The letters were choked with rust and eroded by God knew how many years of blowing sand and grit, but he could still read them. Welcome to the Dogon. 8. Jake expected the door to be locked and wasn't disappointed. The lever handle moved up and down only the tiniest bit. He guessed that when it had been new, there'd been no give in it at all. To the left of the door was a rusty steel panel with a button and a speaker grill. Beneath it was the word Verbal. Jake reached for the button, and suddenly the lights lining the top of the building went out, leaving him in what at first seemed like utter darkness. "They're on a timer," he thought, waiting for his eyes to adjust. "A pretty short one, or maybe they're just getting tired, like everything else the old people left behind." His eyes readapted to the moonlight, and he could see the entry box again. He had a pretty good idea of what the verbal entry code must be. He pushed the button.
"Welcome to Arc Quadrant, Outpost 16," said a voice.
Jake jumped back, stifling a cry. He had expected a voice, but not one so eerily like that of Blaine the Mono. He almost expected it to drop into a John Wayne drawl and call him Little Trailhand.
"This is a medium security outpost. Please give the verbal entry code. You have 10 seconds. 9, 8, 19, Jake said. "Incorrect entry code. You may retry once. 5, 4, 3, 99, Jake said. "Thank you."
The door clicked open. 9. Jake and Oi walked into a room that reminded him of the vast control area Roland had carried him through beneath the City of Ludd, as they had followed the steel ball which had guided them to Blaine's cradle. This room was smaller, of course, but many of the dials and panels looked the same. There were chairs at some of the consoles, the kind that would roll along the floor so that the people who worked here could move from place to place without getting to their feet. There was a steady sigh of fresh air, but Jake could hear occasional rough rattling sounds from the machinery driving it. And while three-quarters of the panels were lighted, he could see a good many that were dark. Old and tired, He'd been right about that. In one corner was a grinning skeleton in the remains of a brown khaki uniform. On one side of the room was a bank of TV monitors. They reminded Jake a little bit of his father's study at home. Although his father had had only 3 screens, 1 for each network, and here there were, he counted, 30. 3 of them were fuzzy, showing pictures he couldn't really make out. 2 were rolling rapidly up and up as if the vertical hold had fritzed out. 4 were entirely dark. The other 21 were projecting pictures, and Jake looked at these with growing wonder. 6 showed various expanses of desert, including the hilltop guarded by the 2 misshapen cactuses. 2 more showed the outpost, the Dogon, from behind and from the driveway side. Under these were 3 screens showing the Dogon's interior. 1 showed a room that looked like a galley or kitchen. 2 showed a small bunkhouse that looked equipped to sleep 8. In one of the bunks, an upper, Jake spied another skeleton. 3 inside the Dogon screen presented this room from a high angle. Jake could see himself and Oi. There was a screen with a stretch of the railroad tracks on it, and 1 showing the little Y from this side, moonstruck and beautiful. On the far right was the causeway with the train tracks crossing it. It was the images on the other 8 operating screens that astounded Jake. 1 showed Took's general store, now dark and deserted, closed up till daylight. 1 showed the pavilion. 2 showed the Kala High Street, another showed Our Lady of Serenity Church, and 1 showed the living room of the rectory. Inside the rectory, Jake could actually see the pair's cat, Snugglebutt, lying asleep on the hearth. The other 2 showed angles of what Jake assumed was the Manny village. He had not been there. "Where in hell's name are the cameras?" Jake wondered. "How come nobody sees them?" Because they were too small, he supposed, and because they'd been hidden. Smile, your uncanny camera. But the church, the rectory, those were buildings that hadn't even existed in the Kala until a few years previous. And inside? Inside the rectory? Who would put a camera there, and when? Jake didn't know when, but he had a terrible idea that he knew who. Thank God they'd done most of their palavering on the porch, or outside on the lawn. But still, how much must the wolves or their masters know? How much had the infernal machines of this place, the infernal fucking machines of this place, recorded and transmitted? Jake felt pain in his hands and realized they were tightly clenched, the nails biting into his palms. He opened them with an effort. He kept expecting the voice from the speaker grill, the voice so much like Blaine's, to challenge him, ask him what he was doing here. But it was mostly silent in this room of not-quite ruin, no sounds but the low hum of the equipment and the occasionally raspy whoosh of the air exchangers. He looked over his shoulder at the door and saw it had closed behind him on a pneumatic hinge. He wasn't worried about that. From this side, it would probably open easily. If it didn't, good old 99 would get him out again. He remembered introducing himself to the Foken that first night in the pavilion, a night that already seemed a long time ago. "I am Jake Chambers, son of Elmer, the line of Eld," he had told them. "The Ka-Tet of the 99." Why had he said that? He didn't know. All he knew was that things kept showing up again. In school, Miss Avery had read them a poem called The Second Coming by William Butler Yeats. There had been something in it about a hawk turning and turning in a widening gyre, which was, according to Miss Avery, a kind of circle. But here, things were in a spiral, not a circle. For the Ka-Tet of 19, or of the 99, Jake had an idea they were really the same, things were tightening up even as the world around them grew old, grew loose, shut down, shed pieces of itself. It was like being in the cyclone which had carried Dorothy off to the land of Oz, where witches were real and bumhugs ruled. To Jake's heart, it made perfect sense that they should be seeing the same things over and over, and more often, because movement on one of the screens caught his eye. He looked at it, and saw Benny's Da and Andy the messenger robot coming over the hilltop guarded by the cactus sentries. As he watched, the spiny barrel arms swung inward to block the road and, perhaps, impale the prey. Andy, however, had no reason to fear cactus spines. He swung an arm and broke one of the barrels off halfway down its length. It fell into the dust, spurting white goo. Maybe it wasn't sap at all, Jake thought. Maybe it was blood. In any case, the cactus on the other side swiveled away in a hurry. Andy and Ben Sleitman stopped for a moment, perhaps to discuss this. The screen's resolution wasn't clear enough to show if the human's mouth was moving or not. Jake was seized by an awful, throat-closing panic. His body suddenly seemed too heavy, as if it were being tugged by the gravity of a giant planet like Jupiter or Saturn. He couldn't breathe. His chest lay perfectly flat. This is what Goldilocks would have felt like, he thought in a faint and distant way, if she had awakened in the little bed that was just right to hear the three bears coming back in downstairs. He hadn't eaten the porridge, he hadn't broken Baby Bear's chair, but he now knew too many secrets. They boiled down to one secret. One monstrous secret. Now they were coming down the road. Coming to the Dogon. Oi was looking up at him anxiously, his long neck stretched to the max, but Jake could barely see him. Black flowers were blooming in front of his eyes. Soon he would faint. They would find him stretched out here on the floor. Oi might try to protect him, but if Andy didn't take care of the bumbler, Ben Sleitman would. There were four dead rock cats out there, and Benny's Da had dispatched at least one of them with his trusty Ba. One small, barking billy bumbler would be no problem for him. "Would you be so cowardly, then?" Roland asked inside his head. "But why would they kill such a coward as you? Why would they not just send you west with the broken ones who have forgotten the faces of their fathers?" That brought him back. Most of the way, at least. He took a huge breath, yanking in air until the bottoms of his lungs hurt. He let it out in an explosive whoosh. Then he slapped himself across the face, good and hard.
"Ache!"
Oi cried in a reproving, almost shocked voice.
"It's okay," Jake said.
He looked at the monitors showing the galley and the bunk room and decided on the latter. There was nothing to hide behind or under in the galley. There might be a closet, but what if there wasn't? He'd be screwed.
"Oi, to me,"
he said, and crossed the humming room beneath the bright white lights. 10. The bunk room held the ghostly aroma of ancient spices, cinnamon and clove. Jake wondered, in a distracted back-of-the-mind way, if the tombs beneath the pyramids had smelled this way when the first explorers had broken into them. From the upper bunk in the corner, the reclining skeleton grinned at him as if in welcome. "Feel like a nap, little trailhand? I'm taking a long one." Its ribcage shimmered with silky overlays of spiderweb, and Jake wondered, in that same distracted way, how many generations of spider babies had been born in that empty cavity. On another pillow lay a jawbone, prodding a ghostly, ghastly memory from the back of the boy's mind. Once, in a world where he had died, the gunslinger had found a bone like that and used it. The forefront of his mind pounded with two cold questions and one even colder resolve. The questions were how long it would take them to get here and whether or not they would discover his pony. If Sleitman had been riding a horse of his own, Jake was sure the amiable little pony would have whinnied a greeting already. Luckily, Sleitman was on foot, as he had been last time. Jake would have come on foot himself had he known his goal was less than a mile east of the river. Of course, when he'd snuck away from the Rocking Bee, he hadn't even been sure that he had a goal. The resolve was to kill both the Tin Man and the Flesh and Blood Man if he was discovered. If he could, that was. Andy might be tough, but those bulging blue glass eyes looked like a weak point. If he could blind him. "There'll be water if God wills it," said the gunslinger, who now always lived in his head, for good and ill. "Your job now is to hide, if you can. Where?" Not in the bunks. All of them were visible in the monitor covering this room, and there was no way he could impersonate a skeleton.
Under one of the two bunk stacks at the rear? Risky, but it would serve, unless...
Jake spied another door. He sprang forward, depressed the lever handle, and pulled the door open. It was a closet. And closets made fine hiding places, but this one was filled with jumbles of dusty electronic equipment, top to bottom. Some of it fell out.
Beans,
he whispered in a low, urgent voice. He picked up what had fallen, tossed it high and low, then shut the closet door again. Okay, it would have to be under one of the beds.
Welcome to Ark Quadrant Outpost 16,
boomed the recorded voice. Jake flinched and saw another door, this one to his left, and standing partway open.
Try the door, or squeeze under one of the two tiers of bunks at the rear of the room.
He had time to try one bolt hole or the other, but not both.
This is a medium security outpost.
Jake went for the door, and it was just as well he went when he did, because Sleitman didn't let the recording finish its spiel. 99, came his voice from the loudspeakers, and the recording thanked him. It was another closet, this one empty except for two or three moldering shirts in one corner and a dust-caked poncho slumped on a hook. The air was almost as dusty as the poncho, and Oi uttered three fast, delicate sneezes as he padded in. Jake dropped to one knee and put an arm around Oi's slender neck.
No more of that, unless you want to get us both killed, he said. You be quiet, Oi.
Quiet, Oi,
the bumbler whispered back and winked. Jake reached up and pulled the door back to within 2 inches of shut, as it had been before. He hoped. 11. He could hear them quite clearly, too clearly. Jake realized there were mics and speakers all over this place. The idea did nothing for his peace of mind, because if he and Oi could hear them... It was the cactuses they were talking about, or rather that Sleitman was talking about. He called them boom flurry, and wanted to know what had gotten them all fashed.
Almost certainly more rock cats, Sai,
Andy said in his complacent, slightly prissy voice. Eddie said Andy reminded him of a robot named C-3PO in Star Wars, a movie to which Jake had been looking forward. He had missed it by less than a month.
It's their mating season, you know.
Piss on that, Sleitman said. Are you telling me Boom Flurry don't know rock cats from something they can actually catch and eat? Someone's been out here, I tell you, and not long since.
A cold thought slipped into Jake's mind. Had the floor of the Dogon been dusty? He'd been too busy gawking at the control panels and TV monitors to notice. If he and Oi had left tracks, those two might have noticed already. They might only be pretending to have a conversation about the cactuses while they actually crept toward the bunkroom door. Jake took the Ruger out of the docker's clutch and held it in his right hand with his thumb on the safety.
A guilty conscience doth make cowards of us all,
Andy said in his complacent, just-thought-you'd-like-to-know voice.
That's my free adaptation of a...
Shut up, you bag of bolts and wires,
Sleitman snarled. Then he screamed. Jake felt Oi stiffen against him, felt his fur begin to rise. The bumbler started to growl. Jake slipped a hand around his snout.
Let go, Sleitman cried out. Let go of me.
Of course, Sai Sleitman, Andy said, now sounding solicitous. I only pressed a small nerve in your elbow, you know. There would be no lasting damage unless I applied at least 20 foot-pounds of pressure.
Why in the hell would you do that?
Sleitman sounded injured, almost whiny.
Ain't I doing all you could want and more? Ain't I risking my life for my boy?
Not to mention a few little extras, Andy said silkily. Your spectacles. The music machine you keep deep down in your saddlebag. And, of course...
You know why I'm doing it and what had happened to me if I was found out, Sleitman said.
The whine had gone out of his voice. Now he sounded dignified and a little weary. Jake listened to that tone with growing dismay. If he got out of this and had to squeal on Benny's da, he wanted to squeal on a villain.
Yar, I've taken a few little extras. You say true, I say thank you. Glasses so I can see better to betray the people I've known all my life. A music machine so I won't have to hear the conscience you prate about so easy and can get to sleep at night.
Then you pinch something in my arm that makes me feel like my Byriza eyes are going to fall right out of my Byriza head.
I allow it from the rest of them, Andy said, and now his voice had changed.
Jake once more thought of Blaine, and once more his dismay grew. What if Tian Jaffords heard this voice? What if Von Eisenhardt heard it, Overholzer, the rest of the Falcon?
They heap contumely on my head like hot coals, and never do I raise a word of protest, let alone a hand. Go here, Andy. Go there, Andy. Stop your foolish singing, Andy. Stuff your prattle. Don't tell us of the future, because we don't want to hear it. So I don't, except of the wolves, because they'd hear what makes 'em sad, and I'd tell 'em yes, I would. To me, each tear's a drop of gold. You're no but a stupid pile of lights and wires, they say. Tell us the weather, sing the babby to sleep, then get the hell out of here. And I allow it. Foolish Andy am I, every child's toy and always fair game for a tongue-whipping. But I won't take a tongue-whipping from you, Sai. You hope to have a future in the Kala after the wolves are done with it for another few years, don't you?
You know I do, Sleichman said, so low Jake could barely hear him. And I deserve it.
You and your son both say thank you, passing your days in the Kala, both say Kamala. And that can happen, but it depends on more than the death of the Outworlders. It depends on my silence. If you want it, I demand respect.
That's absurd, Sleichman said after a brief pause. From his place in the closet, Jake agreed wholeheartedly. A robot demanding respect was absurd. But so was a giant bear patrolling an empty forest, a Morlock thug trying to unravel the secrets of dipolar computers, or a train that lived only to hear and solve new riddles.
And besides, hear me, I beg, how can I respect you when I don't even respect myself?
There was a mechanical click in response to this, very loud. Jake had heard Blaine make a similar sound when he, or it, had felt the absurd closing in, threatening to fry his logic circuits. Then Andy said,
No answer, 19. Connect and report, Sai Sleichman. Let's have done with this.
All right.
There were 30 or 40 seconds worth of keyboard clatter, then a high, warbling whistle that made Jake wince and Oi whine far back in his throat. Jake had never heard a sound quite like it. He was from the New York of 1977, and the word modem would have meant nothing to him. The shriek cut off abruptly. There was a moment's silence, then,
This is Algol Siento, Finley Otego here. Please give your password. You have 10 seconds.
Saturday, Sleichman replied, and Jake frowned. Had he ever heard that happy weekend word on this side? He didn't think so.
Thank you. Algol Siento acknowledges. We are online.
There was another brief, shrieking whistle, then,
Report, Saturday.
Sleichman told of watching Roland and the younger one going up to the Cave of the Voices, where there was now some sort of door, very likely conjured by the Manny. He said he'd used the Farseer and thus gotten a very good look.
Telescope, Andy said.
He had reverted to his slightly prissy, complacent voice.
Such are called telescopes.
Would you care to make my report, Andy? Sleichman inquired with cold sarcasm.
Cry pardon, Andy said in a long-suffering voice. Cry pardon, go on as you will.
There was a pause. Jake could imagine Sleichman glaring at the robot, the glare robbed of its ferocity by the way the foreman would have to crane his neck in order to deliver it. Finally he went on. They left their horses below and walked up. They carried a pink sack, which they passed from hand to hand as if 'twere heavy. Whatever was in it had square edges. I could make that out through the telescope, Farseer. May I offer 2 guesses?
Yes.
First, they might have been putting 2 or 3 of the pair's most valuable books in safekeeping. If that's the case, a wolf should be sent to destroy them after the main mission's accomplished.
Why?
The voice was perfectly cold, not a human being's voice, Jake was sure of that. The sound of it made him feel weak and afraid. Why, as an example, do it please ya, Sleitman said, as if this should have been obvious. As an example to the priest.
Callahan will very soon be beyond examples, the voice said. What is your other guess?
When Sleitman spoke again, he sounded shaken. Jake hoped the traitor son of a bitch was shaken. He was protecting his son, sure, his only son. But why he thought that gave him the right... It may have been maps, Sleitman said. I've thought long and long that a man who has books is apt to have maps. He may have given him maps of the eastern regions leading into Thunderclap. They haven't been shy about saying that's where they plan to head next. If it is maps they took up there, much good may they do him, even if they live. Next year, north'll be east, and likely the year after, it'll swap places with south. In the dusty darkness of the closet, Jake could suddenly see Andy watching Sleitman make his report. Andy's blue electric eyes were flashing. Sleitman didn't know. No one in the Kala knew, but that rapid flashing was the way DNF-34821-V-63 expressed humor. He was, in fact, laughing at Sleitman. Because he knows better, Jake thought. Because he knows what's really in that bag, bet a box of cookies that he does. Could he be so sure of that? Was it possible to use the touch on a robot? If it can think, the gunslinger in his head spoke up, then you can touch it. Well, maybe. Whatever it was, it's a damn good indication they really do plan to take the kids into the Arroyos, Sleitman was saying. Not that they'd put him in that cave.
No, no, not that cave, Andy said, and although his voice was as prissy serious as ever, Jake could imagine his blue eyes flashing even faster. Almost stuttering, in fact. Too many voices in that cave. They'd scare the children, you're a bugger.
DNF-34821-V-63, messenger robot. Messenger! You could accuse Sleitman of treachery. But how could anyone accuse Andy of it? What he did, what he was, had been stamped on his chest for the whole world to see. There it had been in front of all of them. Gods! Benny's Da, meanwhile, was plodding stolidly on with his report to Finley Otego, who was in some place called Al Gulciento. The mine he showed us on the map the Taveries drew is the Gloria, and the Gloria ain't but a mile off from the Cave of the Voices, but the bastard's trig. Can I give another guess?
Yes.
The arroyo that leads to the Gloria mine splits off to the south about a quarter mile in. There's another old mine at the end of the spur, the Redbird II, it's called. Their din is telling folks he means to put the kids in the Gloria, and I think he'll tell them the same at the meeting he's going to call later this week, the one where he asks leave to stand against the wolves. But I believe that when the time comes, he'll stick them in the Redbird instead. He'll have the Sisters of Oriza standing guard, in front and up above as well, and you'd do well not to underestimate those ladies.
How many?
I think five, if he puts Sari Adams among him. Plus some men with Baz. He'll have the brownie throwing with him, Kennet, and I hear she's good. Maybe best of all. But one way or the other, we know where the kids are going to be. Putting them in such a place is a mistake, but he don't know it. He's dangerous, but grown old in his thinking. Probably such a strategy has worked for him before. And it had, of course. In Eyebolt Canyon. Against Latigo's men. The important thing now is finding out where he and the boy and the younger man are going to be when the wolves come. He may tell at the meeting. If he don't, he may tell Eisenhart afterward.
Or Overholzer.
No, Eisenhart will stand with him. Overholzer won't.
You must find out where they'll be.
I know, Sleitman said. We'll find out, Andy and I, and then make one more trip to this unblessed place. After that, I swear by the Lady Oriza and the man Jesus, I've done my part. Now can we get out of here?
In a moment, Si, Andy said. I have my own report to make, you know.
There was another of those long, whistling shrieks. Jake ground his teeth and waited for it to be over, and finally it was. Finley Otego signed off.
Are we done? Sleitman asked.
Unless you have some reason to linger, I believe we are. Andy said.
Does anything in here seem different to you?
Sleitman asked suddenly, and Jake felt his blood turn cold.
No, Andy said. But I have great respect for human intuition. Are you having intuition, Sai?
There was a pause that seemed to go on for at least a full minute, although Jake knew it must have been much shorter than that. He held Oi's head against his thigh and waited.
No, Sleitman said at last. Guess I'm just getting jumpy, now that it's close. God, I wish it was over. I hate this.
You're doing the right thing, Sai.
Jake didn't know about Sleitman, but Andy's plumbily sympathetic tone made him feel like gnashing his teeth.
The only thing, really, 'tisn't your fault that your father to the only mateless twin in Calabrin Sturgis, is it? I know a song that makes this point in particularly moving fashion. Perhaps you'd like to hear—
Shut up, Sleitman cried in a choked voice. Shut up, you mechanical devil. I've sold my goddamn soul. Isn't that enough for you? Must I be made sport of as well?
If I've offended, I apologize from the bottom of my admittedly hypothetical heart, Andy said. In other words, I cry your pardon.
Sounding sincere, sounding as though he meant every word, sounding as though butter wouldn't melt. Yet Jake had no doubt that Andy's eyes were flashing out in gales of silent blue laughter.
12. The conspirators left. There was an odd, meaningless jingle of melody from the overhead speakers, meaningless to Jake at least, and then silence. He waited for them to discover his pony, come back, search for him, find him, kill him. When he had counted to 120 and they hadn't returned to the Dogon, he got to his feet. The overdose of adrenaline in his system left him feeling as stiff as an old man, and went back into the control room. He was just in time to see the motion sensor lights in front of the place switch off. He looked at the monitor showing the top of the rise and saw the Dogon's most recent visitors walking between the boom flurry. This time the cactuses didn't move. They had apparently learned their lesson. Jake watched Sleitman and Andy go, bitterly amused by the difference in their heights. Whenever his father saw such a Mutt and Jeff duo on the street, he inevitably said, "Put him in vaudeville." It was about as close to a joke as Elmer Chambers could get. When this particular duo was out of sight, Jake looked down at the floor. No dust, of course. No dust and no tracks. He should have seen that when he came in. Certainly Roland would have seen that. Roland would have seen everything. Jake wanted to leave, but made himself wait. If they saw the motion lights glare back on behind them, they'd probably assume it was a rock cat, or maybe what Benny called an armadillo. But probably wasn't good enough. To pass the time, he looked at the various control panels, many of which had the Lemerck Industries name on them. Yet he also saw the familiar GE and IBM logos, plus one he didn't know, Microsoft. All of these latter gadgets were stamped Made in USA. The Lemerck products bore no such mark. He was pretty sure some of the keyboards he saw, there were at least 24, controlled computers. What other gadgetry was there? How much was still up and running? Were there weapons stored here? He somehow thought the answer to this last question was no. If there had been weapons, they had no doubt been decommissioned or appropriated. Very likely by Andy, the messenger robot. Many other functions. At last he decided it was safe to leave. If, that was, he was extremely careful, rode slowly back to the river and took pains to approach the rocking bee the back way. He was nearly to the door when another question occurred to him. Was there a record of his and Oi's visit to the Dogon? Were they on videotape somewhere? He looked at the operating TV screens, sparing his longest stare for the one showing the control room. He and Oi were on it again. From the camera's high angle, anyone in the room would have to be in that picture. Let it go, Jake, the gunslinger in his head advised. There's nothing you can do about it, so just let it go. If you try poking and prying, you're apt to leave sign. You might even set off an alarm. The idea of tripping an alarm convinced him. He picked up Oi, as much for comfort as anything else, and got the hell out. His pony was exactly where Jake had left him, cropping dreamily at the bushes in the moonlight. There were no tracks in the hard pan, but, Jake saw, he wasn't leaving any himself. Andy would have broken through the crusty surface enough to leave tracks, but not him. He wasn't heavy enough. Probably Benny's Dow wasn't either. Quit it. If they'd smelled you, they would have come back. Jake supposed that was true, but he still felt more than a little like Goldilocks tiptoeing away from the House of the Three Bears. He led his pony back to the desert road, then put on the duster and slipped Oi into the wide front pocket. As he mounted up, he thumped the bumbler a fairly good one on the saddle horn.
"Ouch, ache," Oi said.
"Quit it, you baby," Jake said, turning his pony back in the direction of the river. "Gotta be quiet now."
"Quiet,"
Oi agreed, and gave him a wink. Jake worked his fingers down through the bumbler's heavy fur and scratched the place Oi liked the best. Oi closed his eyes, stretched his neck to an almost comical length, and grinned. When they got back to the river, Jake dismounted and peered over a boulder in both directions. He saw nothing, but his heart was in his throat all the way across to the other side. He kept trying to think what he would say if Benny's Da hailed him and asked him what he was doing out here in the middle of the night. Nothing came. In English class, he'd almost always gotten A's on his creative writing assignments, but now he was discovering that fear and invention did not mix. If Benny's Da hailed him, Jake would be caught. It was as simple as that. There was no hail. Not crossing the river, not going back to the rocking bee, not unsaddling the horse and rubbing him down. The world was silent, and that was just fine with Jake. 13. Once Jake was back on his pallet and pulling the covers to his chin, Oi jumped up on Benny's bed and lay down, nose once more under his tail. Benny made a deep sleep muttering sound, reached out, and gave the bumbler's flank a single stroke. Jake lay looking at the sleeping boy, troubled. He liked Benny. His openness, his appetite for fun, his willingness to work hard when there were chores that needed doing. He liked Benny's yodeling laugh when something struck him funny, and the way they were evenly matched in so many things, and until tonight, Jake had liked Benny's Da, too. He tried to imagine how Benny would look at him when he found out that A, his father was a traitor, and B, his friend had squealed on him. Jake thought he could bear anger. It was hurt that would be hard. "You think hurt's all it'll be? Simple hurt? You better think again. There aren't many props under Benny Sleitman's world, and this is going to knock them all out from under him. Every single one. Not my fault that his father's a spy and a traitor." But it wasn't Benny's either. If you asked Sleitman, he'd probably say it wasn't even his fault, that he'd been forced into it. Jake guessed that was almost true, completely true if you looked at things with a father's eye. What was it that the Collars twins made and the wolves needed? Something in their brains, very likely. Some sort of enzyme or secretion not produced by singleton children. Maybe the enzyme or secretion that created the supposed phenomenon of twin telepathy. Whatever it was, they could take it from Benny Sleitman, because Benny Sleitman only looked like a singleton. Had his sister died? Well, that was tough titty, wasn't it? Very tough titty, especially for the father who loved the only one left, who couldn't bear to let him go.
Suppose Roland kills him. How will Benny look at you then?
Once, in another life, Roland had promised to take care of Jake Chambers, and then let him drop into the darkness. Jake had thought there could be no worse betrayal than that. Now he wasn't so sure. No, not so sure at all. These unhappy thoughts kept him awake for a long time. Finally, half an hour or so before the first hint of dawn touched the horizon, he fell into a thin and troubled sleep.
Chapter 4. The Pied Piper. 1. "We are Ka-Tet," said the gunslinger. "We are one from many." He saw Callahan's doubtful look. It was impossible to miss. And nodded. "Yes, Pear, you're one of us. I don't know for how long, but I know it's so. And so do my friends." Jake nodded. So did Eddie and Susanna. They were in the pavilion today.
After hearing Jake's story, Roland no longer wanted to meet at the rectory house, not even in the backyard. He thought it all too likely that Sleitman or Andy, maybe even some other as yet unsuspected friend of the wolves, had placed listening devices as well as cameras there. Overhead the sky was gray, threatening rain, but the weather remained remarkably warm for so late in the season. Some civic-minded ladies or gents had raked away the fallen leaves in a wide circle around the stage where Roland and his friends had introduced themselves not so long ago, and the grass beneath was as green as summer. There were falcon flying kites, couples promenading hand in hand, two or three outdoor tradesmen keeping one eye out for customers and the other on the low-bellied clouds overhead. On the bandstand, the group of musicians who had played them into Calla Bryn Sturgis with such brio were practicing a few new tunes. On two or three occasions, townsfolk had started toward Roland and his friends, wanting to pass a little time, and each time it happened, Roland shook his head in an unsmiling way that turned them around in a hurry. The time for "so good to meet you" politics had passed. They were almost down to what Susanna called the real nitty-gritty. Roland said, "In 4 days comes the meeting. This time I think of the entire town, not just the men."
"Damn well told it ought to be the whole town," Susanna said. "If you're counting on the ladies to throw the dish and make up for all the guns we don't have, I don't think it's too much to let them into the damn hall."
"Won't be in the gathering hall if it's everyone," Callahan said. "There won't be room enough. We'll light the torches and have it right out here."
"And if it rains?"
Eddie asked.
"If it rains, people will get wet," Callahan said, and shrugged.
4 days to the meeting. And 9 to the wolves," Roland said. "This will very likely be our last chance to palaver as we are now, sitting down with our heads clear, until this is over. We won't be here long, so let's make it count." He held out his hands. Jake took one, Susanna the other. In a moment all five were joined in a little circle, hand to hand. "Do we see each other?"
"See you very well," Jake said.
"Very well, Roland," said Eddie.
"Clear as day, Shug,"
Susanna agreed, smiling. Oi, who was sniffing in the grass nearby, said nothing, but he did look around and tip a wink.
"Pear?"
Roland asked.
"I see and hear you very well," Callahan agreed with a small smile. "And I'm glad to be included. So far, at least."